Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
Fried fam, you know that one of the things that I've been trying to do for the past 6 years of this podcast is bring you a sense of relief. That is a goal of every episode, to give you enough learning and a new understanding, a new tool, a something that will allow you to feel that you're not in this alone, that you can get through it, and that you can have this moment of, oh gosh, it's not just me. There are solutions. And today, oh my goodness, get excited, because I have with me Natalie Nixon, PhD, who is the creativity whisperer to the C-suite, which I love that title, and a global keynote speaker who helps leaders unlock creativity's ROI for inspired business results. As CEO of Figure Eight Thinking and the leading voice behind the Wonder Rigor Method, she teaches teams how to work with more imagination and intention, especially in moments of change, ambiguity, or burnout. Her work blends strategy and storytelling, drawing on 25 plus years across fashion, design, academia, and anthropology. Natalie, welcome to Fried.
Thank you so much. It's awesome to be here.
It is awesome to have you. All right, folks. I was reading Dr. Natalie's latest book, and I opened it, and I read the first paragraph, and then I stopped, and I put it down. And I picked it up and I read the first paragraph again, because in that short paragraph, Natalie, you managed to bring that sense of relief that I'm searching for on this podcast all the time right away. So folks, this is a weird start. You know, I don't usually start this way, but I'm going to read you the first paragraph of Dr. Natalie Nixon's book, Move, Think, Rest. Here we go. If you happen to spot me while I'm in the midst of some of my most important work, here's what you'd see. Me, gazing out my office window at the chattering birds in my yard, or taking a leisurely stroll past my neighbor's front stoops, or maybe sitting quietly by myself, staring into space.
That is 100% true.
And it is such a surprise. You say my most important work.
Yes.
Can you dive into this a little bit more for me, please?
Yes. Well, like so many, not just entrepreneurs, but solopreneurs, over the past 9 years, I have done a lot of work to what I call fortify my mind, because you get a lot of no's. You have to remain buoyant. And so I have become much more introspective to fortify my mind and to be more self-aware and to drown out the inner critic, whom I have nicknamed Negative Nancy.
Oh, that's what my grandmother would call it too.
Yeah. I mean, I love Nancy Drew as a girl. I call her Negative Nancy. But I started observing about myself that whenever I would, air quotes, procrastinate, you know, remove the dishes from the dishwasher, do a short load of laundry, go for a walk, take a daydream break. When I returned to the work at hand, my thinking was clearer and sharper. A problem, pickle of an idea that had just been stymieing me. All of a sudden things clicked into place. And initially I was referring to this phenomenon as invisible work. By the time I got to a point where I was framing these ideas as a book proposal, initially the book was going to be called, it was going to have the words invisible work in the title. Mm. But I'm very aware of the work of feminists and their work to acknowledge women's unaccounted for, unpaid for work, which they have called invisible work. So I veered away from that eventually. But that really was the genesis of being very curious about what's happening in my brain, what's happening in my body to really leverage productivity in a way that I don't think we typically think about or consider.
So Fried Fam, if you've been around for a while, you will remember that we had a Janine Letford on some time ago. She's also sort of a creativity expert. She's a wonderful woman. I adore her.
I love her. She's great. Yeah,
she's so great. And she often talks about this idea of brain breaks.
Yes.
Which is sort of kind of leans into what you're sharing here. And I was just, I'm mid book writing right now. I'm supposed to be editing this week. And you know how that goes, how it goes, just is what it is. While I was writing the book, a friend of mine is also writing her book at the same time. And she said that she, you know, cut off all external reading while she was writing because she couldn't stand the influx of other ideas. She needed to get her stuff out. And I stopped and I thought, oh, wow, that's not my brain. I have been reading so much fiction.
Yeah.
Because I need a break from this stuff. And also because sometimes my best ideas come from a conversation that happens just before an awkward romance scene in a crappy chick lit novel.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you. I'm a big devotee of fiction. I've already referenced Nancy Drew was my jam as a girl. I'm just looking for it right now. So I recommit. I have to conscientiously recommit to reading fiction.
Yeah.
Once a quarter, because I'll find myself drifting away to just the serious nonfiction reading. But for example, right now I'm reading from my local free library, How Not to Drown in a Glass of Water, a novel by Angie Cruz. And the beautiful thing about taking daydream breaks, or as Janine calls them, brain breaks, or reading fiction, is that it's really helping us to tap into the default mode network. It's also calming our nervous system. It's helping the autonomic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system to be sparked, which is really essential for our best ideas, because it turns out that when we get out of our head and drop into our body, or allow our mind to wander and really do activity or design space and time, I'm a big fan of the space-time continuum, to daydream, to read fiction, to wonder what if, we're actually helping the neural synapses in different regions of our brain, not the frontal neocortex, but other regions of the brain, which is really where the juicy bits of productivity, as I like to say, happen, and where our best thinking can occur. So anything that you can do to help the default mode network, we can talk more about that, get activated, you are doing yourself a huge favor. So yes to reading lots of fiction. I think of fiction also, Kate, as I dance, I also swim, and often I will read just like 5 minutes of fiction before I have to read some more I won't even say rigorous nonfiction, because for example I was last summer I read the brilliant writer who wrote The Covenant of Water, which was like 700 pages long. Mm-hmm,
I loved The Covenant of Water.
And Cutting for Stone. I'm so sorry, I forgot his name. Brilliant. Abraham Verghese. It's actually quite rigorous fiction. Yeah, so I'm not even gonna say like nonfiction is rigorous and fiction is not, but it's just so helpful to serve as a warm up. I kind of like before I might have a really intensive dance class or a long swim, it's important to stretch and to get limber. And to me, that's how reading fiction, for example, helps to limber up my brain. It helps me to ease into that other modality.
So as I was reading through your book, the part of me that helps other speakers get their messages across and things like that, and even when I listened to you, because I heard you speak at the Initiative for Purpose and Flourishing at NYU Stern this past March, and you do a really good job of making a business case for leaving this creative space. And I want to jump into that because I think that, like, a lot of people that listen to the show are leaders, C-suite leaders, a lot of nonprofit leaders. And I know that sometimes they get kind of confronted with an idea like this and they say, well, we don't have time for that. We can't do that. We need to meet our KPIs. We need to. And I found it really interesting in that your book that you regularly address all of these concerns without naming them as concerns directly, which I thought was really smart. So if somebody's listening, they're a leader, and you're saying, well, we need more creativity. We need this space for people's brains to relax. We need to engage this default mode network. And people are like, yes, but productivity means 8 hours in front of a computer. Let's make the business case.
Yeah, so you cannot afford anymore not to step away. You cannot afford anymore not to build creativity as a strategic capability so that you, your team, your company can more consistently and sustainably innovate and therefore drive more purpose-driven business results. So I'll give just two examples of the solid, bold line between creativity and business ROI versus what some people who may not be convinced yet might think of as a soft, fuzzy, dotted line. It is not. So one example of the condition that we must have for greater creativity is collaboration. Now, most of us, if we're honest, despise collaboration. We'll act like, we love to collaborate. We're all about collaboration. But the reality is that collaboration is hard short term because your assumptions get challenged. And that can feel like a personal affront, especially if you, your team, have been working on something for so long. I often reference the former head of design at Nissan, the automotive company, Jerry Hirschberg. He made up this wonderful phrase, creative abrasion, because he would require people from finance, manufacturing, sales to opine on and join his design team midway through a project. And his designers would bristle at that. And he knew they would bristle at that. But he understood that that tension, that friction, that abrasion, friction yields energy. So why not? He was just thinking, convert the energy into something positive. So short-term collaboration can feel really painful, clunky, awkward, a drain. Long-term, however, collaboration actually increases productivity. When productivity goes up, efficiencies go up. And when efficiencies go up, costs go down. That's an example of a business result that starts from a condition that we need for our best creativity, which is collaboration. And the second example would be inventive thinking. We need to have incredibly audacious, ridiculously appearing inventive thinking to be our most creative. How do you become more inventive in your thinking? Some of it sometimes comes out of collaborating. Sometimes it comes out of in design thinking. We call it lateral thinking and going to a conference that has nothing to do with your sector and the new questions or ideas that it sparks. Curiosity is another way to spark inventive thinking. But when we get more inventive and audacious in our thinking, then we begin to see what in visual art is called seeing the negative space. So, Kate, you and your listeners and viewers probably know of, actually has a name, I'm forgetting the name, but that famous drawing, is it a profile of a woman's face or is it a vase? It's that
optical illusion.
that optical illusion. That's an example of being able to see negative space. So when you learn to first draw, for example, branches in a tree, you're actually not drawing the density of the branches, you're drawing the in-between bits. That's learning to see differently. So inventive thinking helps you to see differently, helps you to see the negative space, it helps you to anticipate what's around the corner. And when you get more inventive in your thinking, you're able to spot new and unpredictable, unpredictable revenue streams, in the sense that you would not have been able to predict them had you not gotten out of your comfort zone and been more inventive in the way you think. So that's an example of another business result, connecting the dots between inventive thinking and new revenue streams.
And I love this idea so much, because I came to the world of working with burnout through Chinese medicine. So my background is in acupuncture and Chinese medicine. I did that for 15 years. Before that, I studied biology as my major. And I know that that was one of your possible pathways that you were thinking through when you went to school. And so I went through this sort of, you know, a little bit of Western work. And then I went through 15 years of Chinese medicine, 20 years, really, if you count the education, 20 years of Chinese medicine, thinking and application, which is a completely different way to look at the world. And then I went through burnout, went back into neuroscience and biology and physiology. What the heck is going on in here? How can I figure this out from a different perspective? And then brought that space. I'm bringing that now to corporate offices and nonprofit offices. That's what I do most frequently. And I was really, I had a huge level of imposter syndrome in the beginning, because I never worked in that corporate space. But the not having worked in the corporate space and having those different disparate, seemingly, sections of my life that come together. I've also lived abroad for 12 years, so I have a little bit of different ways of thinking about vacation and things like that. Those things bring me in as the person who can show up and say it different. And that's one of the things that I love about your story. So can you give people, we're going to back up a little bit back into your story to say fashion, anthropology, what? And I think it's perfect, because it's like you've been setting yourself up for where you are right now your whole life without knowing. It's really cool.
Totally. Definitely without knowing. The root of my very diverse background and series of experiences is grounded in advice that I took from my parents when I guess I was just turned 19. I was a sophomore in college. I had to declare a major in a few weeks, first semester sophomore year. And I called home very nervous with my first world problem of needing to declare a major. And this was in, 1988, when there was a phone in the kitchen and a phone in my parents' bedroom. And each mom was in the bedroom. My dad was in the kitchen. And I'm going through with them the list of possible areas I could study. I did not want to disappoint them. They had sacrificed a lot for a very expensive education. I wanted to get a good JOB at the end of these 4 years. And so I was dancing around the topic, and I was just dropping in impressive sounding majors like economics, which I had almost failed, or political science, which I thought secretly was a little boring, or sociology, which I thought reduced people to statistics. And because they know me well, my mom was like, well, what are you interested in, though? What do you want to study? And quite apologetically, I confessed, I really love this new course I started taking in cultural anthropology. And oh my gosh, these interdisciplinary courses in Africana studies are amazing. I get to dive into philosophy and econ and history from a different perspective. And almost at the same time, my parents said, then that's what you should study. And I just think I heard them correctly. I was like, come again. I was like, so you'd be okay if I studied anthropology and maybe did a double major with Africana studies? And my pop said, Natalie, if you study what you love, you will have to turn down opportunities, because no one will have to tell you to get up earlier or stay later or work harder. And with that, it was just this load lifted off my shoulders. And I have carried that advice forward to follow my heart, to sit with my internal nudges and that intuition, which I now know as a 56-year-old that is actually a much more efficient way to live. It's not always the easiest way to live, because you have to pause. You have to wrestle with that uncertainty. You have to wait. You have to ask for help. You have to
trust.
You have to trust. You have to know how to get more comfortable with diving into experiments. You've got to get more comfortable with sometimes doing the job that supports the avocation until the few of those things begin to merge. And that is why I ended up studying cultural anthropology, worked in the fashion industry first as an entrepreneurial hat designer. I had a business in my 20s in New York City called Nats Hats. And then I worked for a division of the limited brands on the sourcing side for a few years, making bras and panties for the Victoria's Secret brand. But that took me to live and work abroad in Sri Lanka and then Portugal. And then I got tired of being in different time zones for family and friends and got an opportunity to become a professor, because by then I had 5 years of teaching under my belt. I was a middle school English teacher for 5 years in my 20s. Inarguably the best experience for everything I'm going to do, because being a middle school English teacher, you have to have a great sense of humor about yourself. You have to love learning. You have to be a translator, because no one understands what no one will get why 1 + 1 = 2 in the same ways. You'd be able to explain it in 5 different ways. Anyway, all of that advice to follow your heart helped me to accumulate an incredibly diverse portfolio of experiences, which, as you indicated, really set me up very well when I got to my burnout moment as an associate professor and founding director of a really cool MBA program, where I had to contend with, I think it's time for me to move on from what at the time was my dream job and to launch Figure Eight Thinking full time.
So where does, in your mind, the connection happen between preventing burnout on teams and allowing for this creativity? Because we talked about the straight business case ROI, like the direct, strong, bold black line that connects those two things. And I would argue, and I think you would argue also, that there's multiple other, maybe lighter lines that are less obvious that make just as much of an impact. So how can we use, well, let's back up, because we need to take people through motor, right? Like, first, what's the formula for staying creative? How do you stick in that space? And then we'll go from there to how do we use that to help prevent burnout at work?
Oh, no, that's a really helpful and great setup, because you're exactly right. I wrote a book called Move, Think, Rest, Redefining Productivity in Our Relationship with Time, as an offering to give people an on-ramp to do what I call toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems, which is the way I define creativity. The creativity is your ability, my ability, all of our ability to toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems and deliver novel value and discern meaning. But I also was very aware that I couldn't just tell people, okay, off you go, toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems and be creative. Like, how do you do that on a consistent basis? So I'm a frameworks nerd. And so one way to do that is something I offered in my first book, The Creativity Leap, which is to apply the three I's by applying inquiry, improvisation, and intuition. That's one way. That's one on-ramp to help you toggle between wonder and rigor. Those actually can be really three very distinctive on-ramps, because inquiry, curiosity is a big category. So is improv, and so is intuition. And I'm sure you really dive a lot into intuition in your work. But as I got to that place of building out this new version of invisible work, thinking about how is it that I feel more energized and my thinking is clearer and sharper when I take these pauses and step away from my work, that led to the development of this human-centered operating system I call MOTR, or MTR, the Move, Think, Rest system. So it's not a sequential system. It's not like first you move, then you think, and then you rest. It's actually very iterative. It's very situational. And movement is not about going to the gym every day. Movement is about what I call movement hygiene. just as we can be hygienic in cleanliness, we need to be hygienic in terms of getting our doses of movement throughout the day, especially because as a species, we've become so sedentary and we are actually designed to move. So the spinal cord is an extension of the medulla oblongata. And the more we sit cramped over a laptop, the more we are restricting blood flow to the brain, which means we are constricting oxygen to the brain, which means we actually are not going to be doing our best thinking if we don't make sure that we integrate standing, walking as we talk and think. When we move, our ideas move. So that's what movement is. Thought is about not just focusing on clear, rational, cognitive thinking that helps you get great standardized test scores, but what's the type of thinking? What are the modalities of thought that lead to that clearer thinking? And I call it backcasting and forecasting. So backcasting is about reflection, memory, metacognition. Why do I think the way I think about this? Why does our team think about this way? Why does our organization think the way we think about this particular sector in this moment in time? So we can scale it out and all the motor dimensions from the individual to the team to the organization. Forecasting is about the role of imagination, and inspiration, and curiosity. And then rest is about intermittent rest. It's about making sure that you have on your calendar, and I literally do, I have times on my calendar just called buffer. And I like to work in sprints in really odd number increments, like 17 minutes or 29 minutes, and then make sure that I push away from the desk, stand up, and even if it's if I'm walking around my desk, and then, you know, making sure that rest often can be full of movement. Rest can be the daydream breaks that I like to take, just 90-second daydream breaks. But rest can also be scaled out much longer than what you block out throughout your day, and making sure, of course, that you don't, if at all possible, do not have back-to-back Zoom and Teams meetings. But, you know, rest can be intermittent micro retreats that your team has. And by micro, I mean be half a day, or if it's a solo micro retreat, maybe you make sure that once a quarter you can take a day in a different neighborhood in your city, for example. But rest can also be scaled out to sabbatical. So I interviewed almost 60 people for Move, Think, Rest, and with one of the group of cohort people I interviewed were people who had taken sabbatical. And interestingly, great business case for sabbatical. Those people who take sabbatical aren't ready to submit their resignation when it's done. They actually show up, they return feeling heard and seen. They return much more devoted to the organization and to the company and to their teams.
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing that Boeing is offering. I can't remember the name of the program now, but Boeing has a reentry program after a longer time away. It's a 12-week reentry back into the office. So you're not just coming back from a sabbatical or an FMLA or some time off and just sort of jumping in, you know, in the deep end day one. They have, I think it's called Return to Flight. Or I can't remember the exact.
I love that.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's like, this is the kind of thing that we're building into the future of work. This is how we're shifting. And I think that it's a fabulous idea to move in this direction and leave people space for just different periods of life. You talked a lot in your book going through the various industrial revolution and how that affected how we were working and how that still affects how we work and how we measure output and all of that. And I think that there's this, we're in this weird time where we know that things are changing and we know the measurements are changing, but we don't know where they're going yet. And we don't know if we can maintain what we've got on less hours. And we're, you know, there's 4-day work weeks over here and unlimited PTO over there and sabbaticals over there. Like there's little sparks of things happening all over and we're not sure how that's all going to work.
Well, and that not knowing, that ambiguity, that liminal space terrifies a lot of us. And it's understandably really scary because you don't know what's next. However, there's different types of not knowing, different types of liminal space and ambiguity. Like, I'm not making light of uncertainty and ambiguity. There's an uncertainty that is really justifiably unsettling if you've lost your home to a fire. And then there is this sort of ambiguity that comes from liminal space, where if a lot of us reflect on our lives, our professional development, a lot of our best work and leaps forward and innovation comes from being at the precipice of that chasm, because it requires you to pause. It requires you to reflect. It requires you to ask for advice and help. It requires you to envision what's possible. And so to reframe that ambiguity and that knowing by reflecting on the times when ambiguity actually can serve us well. And also, it's not going anywhere. Like, there's so much gray in life. We kind of want to force upon the ways that we work and the ways we design leadership as it's full of certainty. It's not the case. And if I could just share an anecdote that has really informed my work. When I was leading the strategic design MBA program at what's now Thomas Jefferson University, we used to have design and dine evenings where I would invite in, successful startup leaders and business leaders to share their stories with our graduate students who were all working full time while they were in school. And to a successful leader, as they were sharing their origin story, there was always this moment when they would say something like, "Something told me not to do the deal," or "Something told me to work with her but not him, even though her pedigree wasn't as impressive." And that something is intuition, which is full of ambiguity and liminal space. And it's just interesting and fascinating to me that so many successful leaders acknowledge that that type of ambiguity has been critical, wrestling with it has been, or sitting with it has been critical to their success. And now the neuroscience research has caught up to those nudges, because now we know that there is a direct correlation between something called interoceptive accuracy or interoceptive awareness and being able to make strategic decisions in times of heightened ambiguity. So interoception is that self-awareness that's actually, I was going to say, fired up by activated by the vagus nerve, the longest cranial nerve in our body. Interoception is that that inner awareness is of, I'm safe, I'm tired, I'm hot, I'm cold, I feel not so safe here, I feel good, I feel healthy, something is off in my body. That's interoception. The opposite of interoception is perioception, our awareness of where we are in space. So dancers are really great at perioception. Birds are really good at perioception. If you've ever seen a bird like nail flying straight into a bramble of bushes, of branches, and just like, you know, really landing on a branch. So ambiguity, liminal space, if we can have a more nuanced understanding of that and often how it serves us, I think is really important.
So I will just say that people that have been around Fried for a while are really happy that you just said that, because we talk about interoception ad nauseum on Fried. And the unofficial hashtag of Fried is pee when you need to pee. Because there's one of the ways that we build interoceptive skills is by listening to a signal from our bodies and responding to it, and then doing the metacognition thing, reflecting back on what our reaction was, how we reacted, what our action was, how often we, you know, skip going to the bathroom to write three more emails or whatever. And we talk about this connection a lot here between burning out because you had low levels of interoception, right? There are studies that show that people that have high levels of adverse childhood experiences, also known as ACEs, they end up with a smaller or not as well-formed insula, the part of the brain that's responsible for interoception. And therefore, people that burn out, a lot of us, don't notice it along the way. And then we get mad at ourselves and feel shame that we didn't notice it, but that part of our brain wasn't fully functioning.
We weren't engaging Right. Exactly right. We were not engaging that part of our brain. And I've been there. And the good news is that you can
exactly
re-engage. I mean, I like to say that intuition is like a muscle or a sonar. And the more you use it, the stronger and firmer and clearer and distilled it gets. And the more you ignore it, the flabbier and dimmer it gets. So that's the great thing about the body and nature, is how adaptive it is and how forgiving it is and how possible it is to tap back in.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. So I'm so glad you said that. I know a lot of my listeners are so glad you said that. That was a happy moment. All right. So now let's get into the creativity and burnout connection. When you're burnt out, access to your creativity is in the tank. And creators is a funny word now, right? Because creators is anything from people who are using artistic skills to people that are making YouTube videos right now. There's, you know, that's a big word right now, but creators also burn out. So it's not necessarily that this iteration that they're going through is always protective. So then where do creativity and burnout intersect, and how can we use creativity to alleviate and or prevent some burnout?
Well, I like that you gave a really great, you attached a really great visual of a word to burnout. You said your tank is empty. And so the way that I like to, for us to think about creativity, is that it is our ability to toggle between wonder and rigor to solve problems. And if you begin to think about creativity in that way, then you quickly realize that artists do not have an ownership of that capability of creativity. Artists are just exceptional at sitting with the ambiguity of the process of designing more space and time for the wonder and for the rigor. So for example, if you've ever gone to an artist's work in process, or met the choreographer after a work in progress, or you go to an artist studio and you ask them, so what's next? Or how are you thinking about this? And they will quite calmly and happily say, I don't really know. You know, they're okay with that ambiguity. And they're really good at designing ways to fill their tank with wonder, but also to fill their tank with rigor. So I look at the intersection between creativity and burnout as you have stopped designing and devoting space and time for the wonder and for the rigor. People will say, oh yes, of course, there's wonder in creativity. There's a ton of rigor in creativity. Now there's a difference between rigor and rigidity. And when we start becoming rigid, that can often lead to the burnout. Rigor is adaptive. Both rigor and wonder require us to zoom out. They both require us to slow down. So rigor is about skill mastery. It's about time on task. It's about discipline. It's about focus. Wonder is about awe and audacity and curiosity. And you can't do either wonder or rigor at 80 miles an hour. So when whether we are scientists, executive assistants, farmers, teachers, plumbers, or artists, we have to choose to design space and time for the wonder and for the rigor. We have to choose to intentionally design that space and time for our teams, and to develop policy and KPIs and hiring practices and retention practices and incentives, like the one you referenced that Boeing has for their reentry from sabbatical, so that you actually get the best work from your team and from yourself.
My brain is doing things. Sometimes you just have to like let it. I love this. I was listening to an episode recently of someone else, and she got asked a question, and she said, I'm going to talk my way through this, but I don't know if I'm going to get to an answer, but I'm going to think through it out loud with you so that you know where I'm going. And what I'm thinking about now is that the rigidity portion, like that sort of continuum, if you take rigor and make it all the way over into rigidity, that's where burnout lives. That's where burnout lives. And a simple example from my own life just a couple of weeks ago, it was just before the July 4th weekend in the States. That's a holiday for those of you who are listening abroad. And I have put out a podcast episode on Sundays at 12 a.m. You know, as soon as it hits Sunday, I put out a podcast episode weekly for 6 years. Every once in a while, I take a 1 or 2 week break. Usually there is a sort of information before that. When I say, hey, there's going to be a 2 week break coming up. Here's some older episodes you can listen to. And this time I found myself really crunching to get an episode in, which I haven't done in ages, but I've been real busy writing the book and it sort of fell off. And I stopped at some point because I don't do the rigidity thing as much anymore after recovering from burnout. And I thought, oh, I'm actually, you guys, this is wild, but I'm in charge here. This is mine. And if I take a week off and the majority of my listeners are in the US and the majority of them are not going to be listening to a podcast on a holiday weekend anyway, if I take this week off, what happens? And really, let's be honest, nothing happens. And also, what happens for me is that I fall back into my generosity space. So to me, when I talk about a generosity resentment continuum, right? And when you're falling into the rigidity, you start to get resentful of doing all the things and keeping up with all the things. And what do these people expect from you? It's very, this sort of very like martyrful space. And I thought, oh, I can just not do one this week. And then my insides relax, because the rigidity happens physically too, right? Like when you're that rigid, you also have stiff muscles and, you know, like all of that happens together. So I thought, as soon as I made the decision, my whole body sunk. And I thought, oh, I'll just not do that. Yep. And nothing will happen to me or anyone else.
No. Yeah. It's this, we can get off the soap opera train.
Yeah.
Return and pick right back up.
Yeah.
And also, you know, as you're saying, pick back up more revived and rejuvenated.
Yes. And so here's the next thing that I want to talk about. Speaking of rejuvenation, because you use a word in your book often that makes me joyful, because it's a very big word in Chinese medicine, Chinese exercise, Chinese health in general, Chinese health philosophy. Do you know where I'm going already?
No.
No. Okay. And the word that you use is cultivation.
I did not know that word is used a lot in Chinese medicine.
Yeah. So when, you know, all of, you know, what Qigong is.
Yes.
Right. So Qigong, for those of you who don't know, is Tai Chi falls under the umbrella of Qigong. So Qigong actually means the cultivation of energy.
Yes.
And it's the Qigong is any exercise and or practice, which could be a breathing exercise. It doesn't need to be a movement exercise. Qigong is any movement or practice that allows you to cultivate energy in your body and in your life. Mm-hmm. And so you were kept writing about cultivation. And I was like, oh, boy, we need to talk about it. What made you get that? You got there, I think, through the farming.
Exactly. I got to cultivation by doing my own version of backcasting in the research of this book, because I knew if I was challenging the ways we currently think about productivity, I had to understand, first of all, where do our current memes and trust of a model of productivity that's based only on efficiencies, output, and measuring what we can see, what was the world like before the first industrial revolution? And the majority of societies around the world before the first industrial revolution that originated in Europe, Western Europe, were agricultural economies. And then I started thinking about, well, what's the modus operandi in an agricultural economy? In an agricultural economy, it's about cultivation. And then I started thinking about, what does it really mean to cultivate? And not romanticizing farming, because if you talk about VUCA environments, the earth is the original OG of a VUCA environment. Like I've been unsuccessfully tinkering with a small plot of a vegetable garden outside our house for the past 5 years, and it kicks my behind every single summer, but in fall. But So cultivation is just another, I'm saying, let's think about a cultivation 2.0, which is if the ways we think about our work are kind of an either or model, you either work or you play. You either are showing up as your most professional self, and then, you know, your substitute can be your personal avocation self on weekends and evenings. Cultivation offers up a both and model of work. So when we think about the work of cultivating, it values both quick spurts of growth and also slow. It values the solo practitioner and the collective. And it understands that, yes, we have to measure what we see. I'm not disavowing that. But the cultivation mode also understands that there's so much happening during dormancy, when we need to sleep on it, when we need to let things marinate, when we, as the new slang from Gen Z is, let it cook, right? Yeah. There are times where you gotta let it be, and there is still stuff at work. And what really influenced me to understand that and appreciate that is I read a book called Winter, a collection of essays. And I don't like the winter, generally speaking. I'm a summer person. I love the heat. But man, did it help me to appreciate the beauty and specialness of winter, when things slow down, when things are under a period of recuperation and fortification for what is to come. I just spent the July 4th weekend out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where they, which is just a little south of Yellowstone National Park, a lot of grizzly bear sightings. And I learned that I never knew this, but bears are phenomenal animals. And apparently a mama bear gives birth to the babies while she is, hibernating. So the fetus gets released while she's still hibernating. And then as the earth warms up and spring is coming, you know, the babies come to be. And but how things are still happening, right? Yeah. Even though there's this hibernation period. Like, what an incredible example of that. So cultivation is what I'm offering up for of how we can think about our work now, that we have a both and model of work, that we value the solo practitioner, we can work from home, but also embrace and really leverage when we can come together as a collective, that we understand that there's still a lot going on we need to sleep on, and we need to allow people to let the work marinate, and we need to measure what we see. And we can still, with AI, value the incredible speed at which we can get results, as well as appreciate that sometimes the best things are going to come after we get that result. How can we build on it, build upon it slowly? So that's how I think about cultivation.
One of the fascinating things about this is that you said that there's a, you know, the solo cultivation and the team cultivation also matters. And for those of you who are into the woo stuff that we talk about over here sometimes, listen to this. When you do a Qigong exercise by yourself, you can measure the amount of qi being produced in hertz out of the palm of your hand. Wow. When you increase the number of people in the room doing the Qigong, that measure increases too. So when we cultivate together, we cultivate better.
We cultivate
more, which is absolutely really cool. I just think that that's a cool little hat to put on that.
Yes.
Last thoughts. What do you think matters most about this message for people, leaders who are trying to make sure that they're not falling apart and their people aren't falling apart during all this ambiguity and the AI questions and the that we're in right now?
I think what matters most for people who are choosing to pause and wrestle with what does it matter in this time where we're dealing with a lot of tech FOMO, you know, and copy paste and feeling like we can't miss out, is to be assured that moving in a direction where we are, where the goal is to do less better, which is how I dedicated the book. The book is dedicated to all of us who want to do less better. That's actually a really grandiose, compassionate, and humane goal. And what a beautiful time to be alive where we actually have technology that can help us to do less better. Because we can get the answers more quickly, we shouldn't be shoving the found time with more stuff and busyness. We should be using the found time for spaciousness, for reflection, for eyeball-to-eyeball conversations, for collaboration, for critical thinking. It's to understand that the whole point of all this is to amplify what makes us uniquely human. It's not to fall prey to like, oh, I give up, the bots will take over, the dystopian future is coming. Have some agency and insist on public policy and transparency and the design of algorithms that make sure that the bots don't take over, that make sure that what makes us uniquely human remains in the forefront.
I love it. Fried Fam, you know that I thoroughly enjoyed this episode, and I hope that you did too. If you were listening and you were thinking about someone who needs to hear it, stop right now, go send it to them, and then come back to hear where you can find out about where to find Natalie Nixon, where her stuff lives online, where you should be following, where you should be listening, and what you should be reading. Now it's your turn. Where should people go to find you, to learn more, to say, oh my God, I can't believe people are actually talking about this and getting paid for it in a world that is so focused on the KPI and the SOP and the.
Well, yeah, as you know, I offer alternative KPIs in Move, Think, Rest. Every chapter ends with reflection questions, exercises for your team, for your individuals, for the organization. But Kate, thank you for having me. Anyone who wants to get in touch, dig into more of my work, just go to figure8thinking.com. That's FIGURE, the number 8 thinking, and sign up for the newsletter where on a monthly basis, lots of gems and techniques and shares in that Wonder Rigger newsletter. Thank you.
And as per usual, Fried Fam, that will be in the show notes. I would never make it difficult for you to find anybody that I bring on here because I'm very careful about who I choose. So thank you so much for being with us today. Leave a review if you haven't already, and we will see you next time.
Thank you, Kate.